Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, designing peace in divided societies. And first, we know there are higher death rates happening because of climate change, but how is it affecting birth rates? Our next guest has some answers. Alan Bereka is a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He is the author of the research paper, Does Hot Weather Affect Human Fertility? Co-author of Maybe Next Month, Temperature Shocks, Climate Change, and Dynamic Adjustment in Birth Rates, and Adapting to Climate Change, the Remarkable Decline in the U.S. Temperature-Mortality Relationship over the 20th Century. So welcome to the Scholar Circle, Alan Bereka. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been studying the human impacts, some of the human impacts that arise from climate change, both kind of from the mortality aspect, but also from the fertility aspect.
Yeah, that's correct.
Maybe we should start with mortality. Would you say your work suggests there's been an adaptation to climate change?
Yes, there's been a pretty big adaptation since the 1940s and 50s, especially. And this messes up with a period when air conditioning was rolling out across the United States. And I arrived at this conclusion about the importance of adaptation from looking at mortality records from the United States going back all the way to 1900. So looking at periods, say, in California that were unusually hot, do they time up with periods where you see also spikes in death rates? And what we found was, yes, so hot weather causes more deaths. And I think that the striking thing is that the early 20th century United States was very similar to, say, India or other developing countries today in terms of our vulnerability to hot weather. It was a major killer. And it's really staggering how much more adapted or how much less vulnerable we became after the 1950s, 60s, 70s when air conditioning really, really rolled out across the United States.
Yeah, so that's interesting because it simultaneously rolling out that air conditioning then just contributes to climate change, which just means we get hot again.
I know, it really is the unfortunate bit of my public health advice, which is I think that air conditioning is a very effective public health tool. The challenge with this is that it increases greenhouse gas emissions, which then leads to more climate change, which then adds to a public health problem.
Right.
So potentially with cleaner energy, I think we can have both the health savings from air conditioning without as much of the health costs. So that would be my hope and dream is that as we adapt with more air conditioning, and I think that seems to be a really great strategy, that we also cut back on our fossil fuels.
Now, what exactly are the things that are causing the mortality? Can you tell that from your research? I did notice one thing you pointed to was humidity specifically. Do we have a sense of why is it that with more heat, higher mortality rates?
So cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death around the world. And our cardiovascular health is also very sensitive to the temperature. Our bodies are just working much harder during the heat and also during the cold to regulate our temperature. So pumping blood closer to the surface of our skin, sweating, and that puts a strain on the body. So if you're already at risk to cardiovascular disease and you add extreme temperatures on top of that, a heat wave, then that's what's leading to most of the deaths, actually.
Now, you also looked at fertility. And so you noticed fertility rates were in decline in certain regions. Can you walk us through what you found and what these relationships are to climate change?
Okay, so what I noticed in the data in the U.S. and say in New Zealand or Australia or, you know, in Europe is that we actually see fewer births in the spring months and more births in the summer months. So I wanted to know whether temperature or seasonal fluctuations in the weather could predict this. So similar to my research on death and mortality, I went back and I collected death records, fertility records in the U.S., birth rates going back to the 1930s. And these are, so this is like 200 plus million births over this time period, going all the way back to the 1930s. And I matched it up with weather data. And I looked at, okay, if it's an unusually hot August, say in California in 1947, what happens to birth rates 9 months later? Obviously, since, you know, around the time of, you know, conception, between conception and birth, there's going to be some delay of about 9 months for most births. So I'm looking from August 47, say, to May of 1948. What do we see? We actually see a big reduction in births. So each hot day results in about 1,000 fewer births that 9 months later. And so this can help explain why we see a dip in births during the spring months.
And so what do we attribute this to? How is the climate affecting conception?
Well, there's two, I guess, obvious ways in which this temperature extreme heat could impact our conception chances. The first being sexual activity. So if it's extremely hot, maybe that just makes all physical activity more uncomfortable, so people are conceiving less. But I should say that I looked at the data and it doesn't seem to back that story up. The second potential explanation is that hot weather, just like for our chances of dying, hot weather is a strain on human health, and health is important for our conceptions. So if you're not in good health, your chances of successfully conceiving go down. And the data seem to back this up.
So I wonder, I know you study human mortality and human birth rates, but I wonder if, since you said air conditioning has this really important effect on making sure that we stay alive, because it supports our cardiovascular, et cetera, could this be connected to the reduction in certain animals and the climate-related deaths in animals because they can't conceive as much and because of the stress on their bodies?
I'd say it's very, very plausible. So for humans, one of the leading reasons why, you know, temperature might be causing a reduction in our conception chances is that actually human mammals we're very sensitive to the heat, especially males. So the testes, they require temperatures that are just a few degrees below the natural core body temperature. And other animals actually have the same necessities. So what, as part of this research, I dug in a little bit into the animal studies, and I found some cases where for bulls, say, for example, that their sperm production was reduced following exposure to extreme heat. So it's very likely.
So if you were going to map this out a little bit, and I think that you did a little bit of that in your study, where are you seeing the effects the most?
This is actually, it's a bit complicated because on one hand, places that experience a lot of hot weather, say like the southern part of the United States, so Louisiana, so places like that experience a lot of hot weather are more vulnerable. But on the other hand, places like Louisiana that experience a lot of hot weather are just more adapted. They're just used to it. So I used to live in New Orleans, and I can say that it's pretty rare to not have air conditioning in your home or your place of work. So there are these two countervailing forces. But it seems like with climate change, so say going to the next 50 years, the places that are going to be the most vulnerable will potentially be places like San Francisco, Seattle, where there's really very little air conditioning. And as the temperatures rise, before this adaptation kicks in, people are going to suffer.
And then you wrote about a rebound effect. What is this?
So going back to the main finding, we saw that during the hot summer month, there was a reduction in births 9 months later. Okay, so if it's a really hot summer, and you're unable to conceive, and you continue engaging in unprotected sex, whether or not you're intentionally trying to get pregnant or unintentionally do so, that if you can't conceive in the summer months, that you may just push out those conceptions to November or December. Okay, so that's in some ways good news in terms of our ability to adapt. If you don't conceive in the summer months, you go on to try in the winter months and you're successful. But there's a bit of bad news with that. Even if you're able to make up the conceptions that were lost in the summer in the winter, all those births, a winter conception, those conceptions are going to be born in the following summer. That means third trimester, those women and fetuses are exposed to extreme heat, even more so with climate change. And there's good research, some of which I'm working on right now, to show that extreme heat in the third trimester is bad for fetal health.
So then there's the other aspect of this, which is overall, one of the largest contributors to climate change has been said to be having children. And so when you look at this sort of big picture, like, you know, having fewer children as a result of climate change might actually be a mitigation effect in some way, you know, overpopulation arguments and this sort of a thing.
So I don't really, I don't get a lot of satisfaction from that interpretation, even though I'm very sympathetic to it. For one, those costs are going to be borne on people that are poor and don't have access to air conditioning. And those are not the people that are actually doing the greenhouse gas emitting. So that's kind of upsetting. Two, if we really are concerned about population growth, relying on climate to do the job for us is not an effective strategy. There are some very effective strategies for reducing population growth, and they are providing women with birth control and giving women better employment and educational opportunities. So it's a really ineffective way of solving this climate.
Yeah. Well, I certainly wasn't suggesting it was the way to solve. What I was suggesting is that it is potentially sort of another effect toward. And, you know, it's interesting too, the countries that do have, like you said, air conditioning or better access to doctors, for example, you know, their birth rates are already a bit lower anyway.
Yeah, that's true. And this brings up an important point about where the population growth is a concern and where it isn't. So in countries like the United States, we actually have population growth rates that a lot of policy makers are considering to be too low. And the fact is that our population is aging, and so we have fewer workers who are paying into the tax system to support the elderly that are now collecting, say, Social Security. So that from a, you know, developed country policy, that's also really problematic.
And so where do we go from here with the knowledge that we have on mortality, conception, and climate change?
I think the big takeaway from this is that there are effective strategies for adapting to climate change, and this is air conditioning being the leading case. But it's going to come with more greenhouse gas emissions, and so we need to be simultaneously reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and energy sources that are contributing to climate change.
Alan Bereka, I thank you so much for coming on to the Scholar Circle and sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan Bereka is a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He is the author of the research paper, Does Hot Weather Affect Human Fertility? Co-author of Maybe Next Month, Temperature Shocks, Climate Change, and Dynamic Adjustment in Birth Rates, and Adapting to Climate Change, The Remarkable Decline in the U.S. Temperature-Mortality Relationship Over the 20th century. When we come back, how identity can cause violence and how to make peace in the aftermath. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How do you make peace after fatal conflicts and loss of lands? And what is the role of identity in the conflict and in the peacemaking? With us are two experts. Neophytis Louisidis is a professor of international conflict analysis at the University of Kent and the author of The Politics of Majority Nationalism, Framing Peace, Stalemates in Crises, and Designing Peace, Cyprus and Institutional Innovations in Divided Societies. Madhura Rasaratnam is a lecturer in comparative politics at the City University of London and the author of Tamils in the Nation, India and Sri Lanka Compared.
Well, welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. You've both done some really interesting work with conflict, with peacemaking, with nationalism, with identity. I thought perhaps what we should do is start with identity, because it seems to play a really big role in everything today. Madhura and I, you and I were just talking a little while ago about how even what we see now in the United States seems like it's such a divided society based on some sorts of identity. So maybe we should start with identity politics in the first place. What do you think we need to know, Madhura, about identity, its formation, and the roles that it plays in our politics?
Thank you for that. That's a really interesting way of framing it. I think for me, and what my research has been concerned about, is really a specific form of identity, which is national identity. So we all have these multiple identities. We move in different spaces where we have identities as siblings, as partners, as friends, etc. But there's a particular form of national identity, which most of the time we don't think about, but sometimes it becomes really for some people in some places. And globally at the moment, it's becoming very acute for all kinds of reasons, economic distress and what have you. And national identity is important, although we don't think about it a lot, because it determines where we can go, where we can live, where we have political rights, where we might have social rights, where we have the right to work, what kind of state we have access to. Some people are born in states that deny them citizenship, for example, the Rohingya in Burma at the moment. And other people find themselves in states where perhaps the state wants to exclude them from the national identity. So my kind of focus is really, we have multiple forms of identity, and most of the time our national identity doesn't really matter to us. But for some people in some places, in sites of intense conflict, national identity matters a great deal, because it's about access to these really crucial goods like citizenship, the right to vote, the right to work, the right to live safely. And so my work is really about how is it that some states which have, you know, a diverse group of people, religious, linguistic diversity, most states have these types of diversities. Some states can manage this diversity and find a way of including this diversity within their understanding of the national whole. And in other states, this becomes a site of sort of intense and polarized conflict, and some groups of people get excluded or marginalized, or, you know, as we see happening in Burma, actually physically pushed out of the border.
You know, what would you add to that?
Madhura already said the most important points on this. If one notices how many conflicts we have in the world right now involving identity, we might be tempted to say that there is an overwhelming tendency to associate identities with conflict. We look at Kurdish regions in Iraq, we look at Catalonia as recent examples where we actually have the public voting in referendums in favor of having their own states that would represent their own national identities. At the same time, as Madhura has pointed, there is majority of cases where we don't see these identities emerging in confrontational ways. In most cases, we've seen accommodation, or we have seen groups not fighting necessarily for what they aspire to. And there are different kinds of identity nationalism. Myself, I focus on majority nationalism. Why majorities do not want to compromise with minorities, why they don't want to share power, why they often break relations with other countries and neighbors, why majority nationalism does not welcome migrants in many of the occasions that we see around the world, why there is a strong feeling against migration in many established nations. Another major question of identity. And also, why often we get into situations where there is a minority-majority conflict that becomes intractable in what we usually refer to as deeply divided society. Small places that could be much happier if they had some kind of political accommodation. Yet this majority-minority syndrome prevents them from reaching some kind of political accommodation.
And there are so many questions that I could ask you just based on what you said, like, well, why is it that majorities look at minority identities and don't want to welcome them, say, for example, the refugees, or in the case of Burma that Madura was talking about, actually pushes out the Rohingya? What are you finding in that?
In some cases, it might be because of history. The presence of a minority might not be seen as legitimate because newcomers were not originally welcome. They might be a product of a colonial legacy. Majorities in general would not like to share power. There is a feeling that every person should have equal vote. And often that means that minorities might not receive some form of political equality. It's very hard to convince a majority that they have to share power with a minority at an equal standing. That's a very difficult decision for any majority to accept, unless there is some kind of broader political compromise, as we have seen in some of the Balkan cases, for instance, in Bosnia, in some of the Central African cases, such as Burundi, for instance. But even there is a feeling that if we're a majority, we should have a say of what the country would look like. That often creates a temptation for the minority to fear that they're going to be excluded. And if they can't, and if they have the military capacity to do so, as we have seen in northern Iraq with the Kurds, and we have seen historically with the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the temptation for those groups is to seek their own independence, their own state.
Madura, he mentioned Sri Lanka. I know that's one of the areas that you've been studying. And one of the phrases that you used there was Buddhist nationalism. Is that part of what Neo is talking about?
Exactly. It fits in very much into this idea of majoritarian nationalism. I mean, Sri Lanka is a kind of exemplary case of the types of majority-minority dynamics that Neo was talking about. And also Burma, actually, you can think about Buddhist nationalism in that case. And the dynamic in Sri Lanka is exactly that. So as kind of independence from Britain approached in the early 20th century, political leaders and political actors were having a choice. How do you frame the nation that is about to become independent? Is this going to be a nation that includes sort of everybody? Is it a pan-Sri Lankan or a pan-Sudanese nation in which you're kind of identified by your political rights and your citizenship rights, and which is inclusive of linguistic and religious diversity? Or is the more politically attractive option to say, well, this is a country that belongs to the singular Buddhist primarily? And as Neo mentioned, there's a historical dynamic whereby if you're not a singular Buddhist, if you're a Tamil or if you're a Muslim or if you're a Christian, let's say, your presence is seen as illegitimate somehow as due to the influence of, in the Tamil case, it's the influence of very historic kind of colonialism of the early Middle Ages and then later waves of colonialism. So there's a historical narrative which says, well, the original people are singular Buddhists and these other people are sort of, as Nia would say, illegitimate migrants who don't deserve the same national rights as the majority, as the true sort of the sons of the soil. I mean, you mentioned that you're in the United States. You can see similar discourses there about, you know, who's the real America? Is it the middle America, or is it these elites on the coasts or what have you?
And we also saw the nativist conversation, that nativist idea.
Nativist, yeah. I mean, we saw the same thing in the UK recently, been through a very tumultuous year of referendums, including a referendum to leave the EU, in which, you know, there was this idea that there were the real British people who wanted to leave, the real people, and the so-called non-real British people who wanted to stay in the EU.
One of the things you wrote in your book, Madura, had to do with identity formation, sort of. I'm probably botching that up a little bit. But you talked about how these identities can be sort of deliberately constructed.
Yes, I think that's right. it's a somewhat awkward idea in some ways and counterintuitive because, you know, nationalist movements will often claim that they have these deep and ancient historic roots and that they're not constructed. But the argument really is that although nationalism is the site of often this violent, intense and violent conflict, it really doesn't have to be that way. There are alternatives. There are alternative ways of framing national identity. And so my study was really a comparison of India and Sri Lanka. And the question is, well, India has these similar dynamics, or it has the potential for these similar dynamics of majoritarian nationalism and exclusion. And up until recently, India has done a relatively better job at managing those. Relative, I mean, it's not absolute. And so my argument really is that the reason for that is that there's a way in Indian nationalism was constructed by the Indian nationalist movement from the late 19th century, which was this idea that India is a unity in diversity. So it was a kind of inclusive, pan-linguistic, pan-ethnic nationalist movement. And to some extent, this idea was able to hold this diversity together reasonably successfully for several decades. It is, of course, being critically undermined now by the rise of the Hindu nationalist movement. But nevertheless, we can see that there's a possibility for having a more inclusive idea of who belongs in India. And so what I try to do in my kind of comparison of India and Sri Lanka is to think about why a similar form of pan-Sri Lankan nationalism didn't emerge in Sri Lanka, even though the conditions in Sri Lanka would suggest that it was actually more, that the conditions were more favorable for such a sort of movement. But it didn't happen. And then you had a much more rapid escalation of conflict in Sri Lanka.
Neo, you've looked at quite a few conflicts yourself, including the one from your home country, Cyprus. How do these other conflicts compare with how Madura is describing what's going on with or what has happened with Sri Lanka?
I agree with the observation that Madura has made that institutions are not a panacea in addressing some of these conflicts. However, if we look at federations, since World War II, no federal country has failed, at least in the what we call the developed democratic countries. Even in the developing countries, has been working fairly well. We hear all the time about political instability in Belgium, political instability in Spain, but these are conflicts that have not led to any major calamities, no deaths recorded. Often there is a crisis that is being negotiated slowly, but eventually reaching some sort of stable outcome. We know that some institutions do not work very well. So when I was writing my book, I was very pessimistic about the use of referendums. I was about 2 years ago when I completed that book. I see since then there are not many people who will support referendums in addressing complex problems. I think referendums tend to promote the negative aspects of identities, if you wish. And I think the Brexit case, the Colombian case, the Catalan, the Kurdish referendums are recent cases that testify to that. So we know that some institutions that promote inclusivity and power sharing tend to sustain stability in some of these deeply divided societies. But there is a limitation to this argument because often there is such a historical record that it's very difficult to negotiate with those institutions in the first place.
So when we talk about institutions and power sharing, one of the cases that you had looked at was Northern Ireland, and that's how you and I met actually originally. And I know from my work in Northern Ireland that people kind of feel like that institutionalized the identity sectarianism. How do you see that?
I slightly disagree with that. I agree with the observation. There's a lot of reactions from Northern Irish people about their own political institutions. I think they're not selling their own successes very well. When I went there as a Cypriot, it took me a while to realize how Northern Ireland operates. And it operates in a very simple formula. There is a proportional system of representation. So minority, which is at this stage in their history, the nationalists, they might become a majority at some point in the distant future, are proportionally represented in the assembly. The assembly was oversized. It was more than 100 MPs at some point. And the idea there was to include the smallest groups possible. The other important innovation was that in accordance to how many seats you have in the parliament, in accordance to your electoral strength, you also automatically have the right to be represented in the cabinet. That's almost a unique feature of the Northern Irish system. And given how simple and attractive this idea could be for other Scofflaig, I was puzzled myself why British policymakers didn't try to promote this idea in other divided societies. So it's a very simple idea if you think of the conflict in Syria right now or in Cyprus, since you mentioned my own work on Cyprus. The simplest way of promoting inclusivity is to say to every group that you're going to be automatically represented according to your electoral strength. If there is an important decision that affects your future, then you might have also the right to veto that decision because we don't want you to be negatively affected by the democratic process. Very, very simple idea for places like Nepal, where you have multiple groups. Very simple idea for places like Syria, where you have, again, a multiplicity of ethnic and religious affiliations. So those institutions can be also very simple and elegant. They can be negotiated fairly quickly and do not necessarily lead to these very complex negotiations after having elections that we have seen in places like Belgium, where it's difficult to form a government, or places like Iraq, where you do have quotas for every group, or in Lebanon, but often there is a dominant majority and a dominant leader who finds allies within other groups and supports those allies. There is some kind of tokenism there, and they appoint their own friends from the other community in key position. The group itself feels somehow not represented. The system in Northern Ireland is inclusive in the sense that people vote democratically for those political parties. And what I disagree with many of the scholars in Northern Ireland is that they see it as strengthening sectarianism. And it's true, the Northern Irish public still votes and votes in higher numbers, higher percentages for parties that tend to represent the sectarian lines within Northern Ireland. That's their choice, and that's a democratic choice, one can say. But also the counterpoint to that is that political parties such as Sinn Féin or DUP that have been historically very entrenched on sectarian identity terms have also moderated their own positions.
Madhura, would you agree with this?
I would agree with that. I think that although I'm somewhat skeptical about the ameliorative power of institutions, I also think that when you do have a deeply divided society, and you want to move forward from that, you have to come up with solutions. And one of the key problems is about sharing political power. How is political power to be distributed? And there you have to have institutional solutions. And as Neo says, I mean, if you, as in Northern Ireland or in Sri Lanka, you have to take the facts as they are. And people do vote along ethnic lines in Sri Lanka, in Northern Ireland. And if you simply allow a kind of majoritarian system to operate, which would be the one where you ignore ethnicity and you try and have a first past the post system and don't have proportionality, then you will refeed the dynamics of the conflict about majoritarianism and minority exclusion. This is just based on my comparison of India and Sri Lanka, is that of course what would be absolutely ideal is to have some form of nationalist mobilization before political power that is inclusive. So that is the ideal outcome. And so somewhere like India, South Africa, maybe with the ANC, which is, you know, to some extent ethnically inclusive of a range of different groups and different political persuasions, like the Indian National Congress was at some point, that is the ideal outcome. You have a powerful, inclusive, broad-based nationalist movement that can then set about creating an institutional framework in its own image that can consolidate a sort of inclusive sense of national identity for several decades after independence. But, you know, that is not an outcome you can engineer. And if you haven't had that historical legacy, then what do you do in situations of conflict? And I think in those situations, as in Northern Ireland, you have to take the facts as they are. And the facts as they are is that people tend to be politically aligned along nationalist unionist lines. And that is also the source of the conflict. So institutions in some way have to be able to reflect and negotiate that. Because, I mean, there is no way now for policy to create a unified Northern Irish nationalist movement.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about violent conflict over contested lands in Sri Lanka, Cyprus, the Balkans, and Northern Ireland.
Neo, you used a phrase in your book, and it was kind of the key phrase of the book, innovative institutions. And that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What do you mean by this?
This is a broad term that covers a wide range of political accommodation, conflict mitigating mechanisms. If you're looking at the conflict, you don't have the luxury to ignore any of those. In fact, what you often have to do is to combine them together. The reason is that if you're a majority, as we said, that you're not willing to sacrifice power, share power, there might be something in another domain that you might get in return. So it's very important to look at them together. So one community provides power sharing, but the other community sacrifices on security or the right of return or any other aspect of the peace settlement, federalism, that is very important to the other community who's making their own concession. So one can look at various domains. One could be power sharing. The other one is how you ratify a peace settlement. Do you ratify the peace settlement in a parliament? Does one ratify it in a referendum, which doesn't seem to be working in many of the cases recently? Does one ratify it in a constitutional convention? Could it be a combination? And how do you institutionalize those solutions? The same with power sharing can take very different forms. And the micro dynamics, the micro institutional details are very important. Federalism can be designed in very different forms. One can look at Canada versus United States. They're both federations, they're both in North America, and they're very distinctive. Same with Europe. Countries like Spain or Switzerland or Belgium are very, very different to each other. Even within countries like the United Kingdom, the way Northern Ireland or Wales or Scotland are being treated are very, very different. So you have variations on that. And then you have a third category of institutions that deals with victims of ethnic conflict, and that involves institutions that affect victims of displacement on how are situated within the peace settlement. It involves others who are owners of properties who might be migrants or settlers. We have also the question of settlers in many of the conflicts, or what is defined as settler can be also very difficult in some cases if there has been a generation of people living there. And then you have people who have lost their relatives during the conflict, so victims of conflict who might not know even where their beloved ones are buried. So we have the question of missing persons and what kind of institutions of transitional justice deal with the criminals, people who are trying to provide some truth that might lead to the recovery of those processes. So all these institutions are quite interlinked in my analysis. And one look at the toolbox of institutional solutions that have been employed in other cases, and is there anything we can import for Cyprus in the case of my book and other divided societies that might interest the field more broadly?
And speaking of Cyprus, since you are from there and since you have studied Cyprus, the peace agreement that they were trying to bring about has not succeeded. What do you make of that?
Well, there is very different interpretations. If you look at the political sides in Cyprus, they blame each other, which is not unsurprising. My own work, I try to look at institutions, try to look at the broader picture. So if one looks at what is recommended, let's say, by the scholarship, by the latest that has been written on those topics and what has been done in Cyprus, one could see a contradiction. So most scholars, for instance, they talk about having a parliamentary system being more conducive to these kinds of political experiments. In Cyprus, they're trying to have a presidential system. Most political scientists will argue after the Brexit and Colombia referendum that we have been very cautious with the use of referendums. In Cyprus, it has become part of the initial agreement that any peace settlement will have to be ratified in a referendum. Most scholars and most evidence from divided society talks about broader inclusivity in the peace processes. Yet in Cyprus, instead of engaging with a civil society and engaging with a wider network of political parties, negotiations are always occurring between two leaders, one Turkish Cypriot and one Greek Cypriot. Then there is the question of victims. The way we negotiated the most important issue so far on properties for those who have lost their properties is a priority, obviously, was to try to have top-down criteria on what to do with the properties. And very little has been done to consult the affected persons, owners and users at the same time. So there can be a much longer list of what is done differently to the conventional practice. And one might not expect that you might get good outcomes if you do everything in contradiction with what is with respect. A much bigger issue for the Greek Cypriots is security. Greek Cypriots fear that a very unstable Turkey and a relationship with that might harm them. And for the Turkish Cypriots, it's very important that they retain a status of their own, a territory in the northern part of the island. Yet if they do so, and the terms that they often aspire may not be at the interest of the Greek Cypriot majority. So there again, we have this question of what will incentivize Greek Cypriots to accept a solution that is also compatible with the Turkish Cypriot aspirations.
Madura, what about Sri Lanka and what has happened since the civil war essentially ended? I mean, that was an incredibly bloody conflict.
That's right. And it ended in May 2009 amidst these kind of mass atrocities with dynamics that are very, very similar to what's happening in Burma. And really, I think where Sri Lanka is now is it's post-war, but it's not post-conflict. In some ways, the conflict is actually deepened and intensified in ways that are quite difficult to untangle. So, for example, there's a recent report by a research institute based in Jaffna, actually, where they've done quite detailed mapping of the levels of militarization in the former war zones, which are predominantly Tamil-speaking, and in the areas where the last phases of the conflict took place, the levels of militarization are now that there is one soldier to every two civilians. And so the Sri Lankan military, you know, because of this wave of post-independence majoritarianism, the Sri Lankan military is exclusively Sinhalese. And the population in these former areas is Tamil. This is the population that has, you know, suffered the worst kind of brunt of the war. Many people who have missing relatives, people who are in the final stages of the war, witnessed the mass atrocities, then had people disappeared. And now they're living in the midst of that military levels of militarization of one soldier to two civilians. At the same time, there's no movement at all on any kind of political resolution or any form of sort of at least truth-telling, at least some sense of, you know, that one of the key demands that's being made by Tamil civil society protests, including by there's an ongoing protest now, which is in its almost, I think it's 220 days by Mothers of the Disappeared. And really, all they want is that the Sri Lankan government, one of its own commissions, has acknowledged that it has a list of all the people that it took into custody at the end of the war, who have subsequently not been heard of. And all they want is they want that list to be published. So at least they have an official acknowledgement that, yes, my brother, sister, husband, father was taken into custody. So we can now start an official process of finding where they are, but that list has not been released. The demand is for the list, just to release the list, just so we can know that you acknowledge that you took my loved one into custody. And so this, you know, this ethnic polarization is deepening, but at the same time, it's also the case that Sri Lanka simply is, as a whole, is very precarious. So to sustain this level of militarization in a country that, you know, is growing but is still relatively poor, costs an enormous amount of money. So the Sri Lankan military is 300,000 people in a country that the population is 20 million. So for comparison, the British military, I think, is about 150,000 people with a population of 60 million. This is, you know, one of the highest kind of ratios of military personnel to civilians. And Sri Lanka is not quite in a debt crisis, but has starting to have critically unmanageable levels of debt, a lot of it commercial debt, obviously because of this large expenditure on the military. So you can see that the ethnic polarization is deepening, and this is also kind of feeding a sort of political and economic instability in the country as a whole. And unless really very quickly very pragmatic steps are taken to de-escalate, this can only get more and more unstable. It's difficult to see how it can stabilize in this way at, you know, these levels of militarization, this level of hostility, and this level of kind of really unmanaged expenditure on a military that seems to be just there to sort of police and survey and repress a sort of absolutely war-exhausted population.
Has there been any movement to resolve this?
As I said, there are various kind of efforts at instituting transitional justice processes and constitutional reform processes. But the important thing to remember is that Sri Lankan leaders, because of the long duration of the war, it was 3 decades, and the international engagement in the war by Western states and by India, all of whom in various ways, you know, sought to resolution to the crisis, ineptly sometimes fueled the war, but nevertheless were deeply engaged in the war. Sri Lankan political leaders are really very expert at engaging the international community on a superficial level. So they've developed a way of kind of producing commissions, instigating committees, initiating processes as a means of taking on board international demands for political reform or power sharing or transitional justice or accountability or human rights reform. So as a means of accommodating these demands, they're very good at instituting fairly superficial processes that then just drag on for years and years and years with no outcome. So there's a constitutional reform process. This will be Sri Lanka's fourth. It's not third time lucky, fourth time lucky. I think that the chances are unlikely. What's been released so far of the draft report suggests that the majoritarian features will remain in place. So it's unclear how this is an advance. And as I said, if there was a genuine commitment, you would start by movement on small things like releasing the list of people who were detained, like movement on political prisoners, like repealing the Prevention of Terrorism Act, like the military releasing privately owned lands that it's occupied for decades. And, you know, privately owned lands in the Jaffna Peninsula, which is overpopulated, where land is very expensive. But this doesn't seem to be. I was in Jaffna over the summer. It's very clear that the military is digging in, and not only digging in a military way, but it's also digging in the sense that it's engaging in commercial enterprises, right? Use it on privately owned land. And not only is that legally normatively problematic, but of course, when the military starts to run hotels, engage in farming, run hairdressing salons, run grocery shops, this pushes out the space for local people, which is what the Sri Lanka, because of course you have 300,000 soldiers who are very expensive to maintain. So they have to become self-sufficient, so they engage in economic activity. So the military runs holiday resorts on privately owned land, while the people who own that land sit in refugee camps outside. I mean, Sri Lanka is the end of the war really was just a trigger for a deepening institutionalization of the conflict, actually. Because the war at least provided the moments where there was a balance of forces and perhaps a negotiation. But the end of the war has allowed for a really entrenched and deepening institutionalization of certain really repressive patterns, at the same time, incredibly precarious because they're not financially sustainable. They're not economically sustainable.
When you were talking about entrenched power and superficiality, I was thinking about how that seems like a common dynamic when you are dealing with, like Neo was talking about, majoritarian power, and the people in power don't want to give up power. And so, yes, they give it some lip service. Yeah, look at all the things that we're trying to do. Look, everybody, we're trying to bring peace. I mean, I can think of so many of those situations. But when you started talking about the essential usurpation of all, you know, activities that would normally be within the civil society, I have not heard of anything like that before.
I haven't done the I need to do like full comparison, but I think if you look at the levels of militarization in especially Mulathipu, this place where the last stages of the war were fought, where this figure of, you know, one soldier for two civilians, I can't think of a place that would be that militarized. Kashmir doesn't reach that level. Even Chechnya at the height of conflict doesn't reach that level. And in that district, you know, the military is effectively kind of has a commanding role in directing economic activity, in doling out livelihood opportunities. You know, the military has kind of become the sole employer almost, because it's very difficult for anybody else to start up a business there, because you need to get the right permits, you need to get permission, you need to buy land. And of course, who decides the land can be sold to and not sold to? So, I mean, this is really a fairly unique form of institutionalization of majoritarianism, very problematic and very worrying. And of course, the deeper it gets, the more traumatic it'll be when it unwinds. And it will have to unwind. I mean, it's completely unviable. It's politically unviable. It's economically unviable.
Neo, have you ever seen anything quite like that in any of the studies that you've done?
I think Cyprus comes very close to the ratio that Madura has mentioned. The Turkish military in the northern part of the island is about 1 to 3 civilians, Turkish Cypriot civilians, not counting the people who came from Turkey since 1974, that one can argue that they're part of the same operation. But the very interesting issue and comparison, I think, is how the military competition between Greece and Turkey and the confrontation has harmed both countries. In the case of Turkey, we have seen chronic mismanagement, chronic crisis, economic crisis, which partly relate to the very large budget and, of course, all kinds of political problems Turkey faced because of the clash between military and civilian parties. In Greece, a part of the reason that the Greek economy has suffered such a major, unprecedented for non-wartime economy crisis was the military competition, the military expenditure and the import of arms to keep up with a much larger country such as Turkey. A lot of people will find it ironic, but the Greek Prime Minister, Mr. Tsipras, came to Washington and negotiated a new deal to upgrade Greek airplanes. And a lot of people in Europe found it quite frustrating that Greek economy and the Greek people are going in such a harsh time, but the Greek prime minister is meeting Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is boasting that we're going to have more American jobs selling military equipment to Greece. They found it quite frustrating. There's a lot of reactions in European media, and rightly so, because some of the Europeans are covering these. There are a lot of unhidden costs as well. It's not just the military expenditure. That's, as far as I know, in Sri Lanka as well, in Greece, people are not paid to serve in the military. Often they are recruited as part of their own time. Turkish EU accession might have been a possibility 10 years ago. It didn't happen again because of this competition with Greece, improvement of relations between these countries and their neighborhood has not happened because, again, of the competition. So we're all constrained and we're all losers as part of conflicts. The fact that we cannot reach a political compromise has its economic cost as well as social, political, and military ones.
It really sounds dark.
If I can jump in, it can be very depressing to speak about Sri Lanka, but I don't think that it's not all darkness. The other thing that was also present when I went to Sri Lanka over the summer is, yes, I mean, it's very clear that there is this deepening and this deep institutionalization of these patterns of militarization. But there's also enormous resilience. And, you know, people continue to sort of mobilize. They continue to protest. They continue to seek new forms of politics, to push for a more inclusive society, to push for their rights. And so I think these things never really stand still, so long as there are people who continue to mobilize and to seek something different. And they do, despite, you know, these intense, Sri Lanka has witnessed in the north and the south some very intense levels of repression, then there's hope.
Neo?
Maria, you and I met in Northern Ireland, so you know very well from your own research that very few people were expecting the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. Polls, but also general statements in the press at the time, a year, a month before the agreement, were very negative, very pessimistic. And we have seen in many other conflicts, people are usually not expecting good news, but often good news might emerge and good stories might emerge. I agree with Madura. There is a resilience in the many of the peace processes that we looked at that we often don't necessarily pay the appropriate attention. In Cyprus, there are a good number of bicommunal projects that have been successful, starting from the Committee for Missing Persons, who have successfully recovered almost half of the bodies of the missing from the conflict of 1963, 64, 1974, but also projects that involve the restoration of cultural properties, dialogue between religious groups, dialogue between business groups. There have been so many different projects in just a small island such as Cyprus that give us some element of optimism that at least at the level of the people, if people are left and if they are encouraged through the appropriate leadership and appropriate institutions, we might see a positive outcome sometime very soon.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholars Circle and sharing your research and sharing your wisdom. It's been a great pleasure to host you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Neophytis Louisidis is a professor of international conflict analysis at the University of Kent and the author of The Politics of Majority Nationalism, Framing Peace, Stalemates in Crises, and Designing Peace, Cyprus and Institutional Innovations in Divided Societies. Madura Vasaratnam is a lecturer in comparative politics at the City University of London and the author of Tamils in the Nation, India and Sri Lanka Compared. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.